Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The Washington Post, Rick Atkinson, was perhaps the most honored American journalist embedded with U.S. troops in the Iraq War. Now he's back with a first-hand view of his time with 101st Airborne, of young recruits at war, of the mid-war uncertainties of top commanders in Iraq, and of the role of journalists themselves in a new kind of war. Tonight on Point, Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson bears witness to the war he saw. We begin tonight in Iraq with retired Army Lieutenant General Jay Garner's first day in Baghdad as U.S.-appointed overseer of post-war Iraq. Today, Garner traveled to damaged sites in a heavily armored caravan surrounded by American soldiers. Scott Peterson is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor who's been watching Baghdad live through its post-war chaos. I asked him what Jay Garner's first day in the city was like.
Well, I think Jay Garner today had a firsthand view of what kind of destruction has been wreaked on the capital in Baghdad, due largely to the looting. Of course, there's still deliberate fires that are continuing each day at dusk. Mostly ministries are being torched and that sort of thing, although we're also seeing quite a concerted effort by U.S. forces here to protect banks now. And we find that many banks, in fact, are being surrounded by Humvees and with American checkpoints.
What did Baghdad hear from General Garner today?
Iraqis heard that, he's promising that American forces will do everything in their power to very quickly restore electricity. I think that's really the main signal that people are waiting for to continue on with their normal and daily lives. They've been waiting for more than 2 weeks. They find that hard to believe that the United States hasn't moved faster to make that happen. And they also look back to the 1991 Gulf War, where they said that even though the electricity grid was destroyed, essentially it came back on stream within 40 days. So Jay Garner has promised that this kind of thing will begin working, but he's also promised that it won't be long that he is here. He's figuring that they would have an interim government in place within 3 months, although, of course, they're looking at elections in 2 years' time or even more. So, but the timeline is quite fluid, I think, and really today was a first day for him to have an eye on Baghdad.
Scott, take us down the checklist of what's working and what's not in Baghdad right now. We read that some electricity has come back on in eastern Baghdad, but most of the city still without?
Absolutely most of the city. In fact, I've just come back from a drive through the city at night, and there really are the very slimmest, tiniest areas that have electricity. The water is not nearly as significant a problem. Almost half of Baghdadis have water and have had it throughout this procedure. But, I mean, it does mean, though, that people have complications because without electricity, it means the refrigerators, their freezers don't work. It means they can't pump water often up to their second or third or fourth floor apartments. We're also beginning to see trash collection, garbage collection for the first time in a month. People are very relieved about that.
Though you wrote, Scott Peterson, that the first instance of that you saw was with a stolen garbage truck.
Well, that's right. Yesterday, the garbage truck arrived for the first time, and then they only found that, in fact, it was being driven by a looter, by a thief, who was charging each family 500 dinars, which is the equivalent of about 17 American cents. But it definitely was a Baghdadi twist.
What about food and the fuel to cook it?
Fuel is a problem in the sense that people have their supplies before the war, mostly using propane gas. A lot of those are running out, and now, even though there is propane in the city, it just is a lot more expensive now than it was. It doesn't seem that gas is much of a problem. There are long lines at the gas stations, but, you know, they snake around the corner, but there certainly is no shortage of cars on the streets.
And finally, on the checklist, Scott, what about medical care? We saw lots of images of looted hospitals.
A lot of those hospitals remain looted. This has been one of the tragedies as far as Iraqis are concerned. And there is quite interesting now because there are sheikhs, Shiite Muslim clerics, who have taken over some of the hospitals. Iraqis tell you that that's a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing is that they have restored order. They've not only restored order, they've also ensured that some of the looted material came back. They've been broadcasting from mosques asking people to bring things back, and the compounds in Moss, in fact, are full of looted goods that have been returned. But on the flip side of that coin is that people are concerned that it's kind of a power ploy on the part of some of the Islamist sheikhs, and that is likely to be, in the long term, a possible challenge to American authority here.
And we read that there were, again today, anti-American demonstrations by Shiites. What is, to the extent that it's known, Scott, Jay Garner's plan for restoring order and services to Baghdad and other cities? How is it to be accomplished?
Well, this is a very, very good question, and I'm not sure that he knows the answer to that himself. I think what he's hoping is that if some of these services get restored, if people begin to see in their daily lives things coming back to normal and some degree of security returning to Baghdad and to other cities, that then other issues will sort themselves out. Although there are huge issues that remain about who is going to rule this country, how it's going to be ruled, what the relationship will be between the American military, American civilians, like Mr. Garner, like Barbara Bodine, who's the State Department's representative here, how they are going to relate and how they are going to help to bring up some kind of an Iraqi leadership, because most of the Iraqis in exile, especially those who've come here, including Ahmed Shalabi, who's kind of a pretender to the presidency, they have very, very little popular support here. And so, you know, something like a democratic election, they would never get through that. That said, there are not too many homegrown Iraqis exactly vying for the top spot either. So we really have a very, very long way to go, I think, before we see something that's going to be stable, that's going to be lasting, and something that's going to be sufficiently strong to enable American forces to withdraw with any degree of confidence.
But in short order, in the next week, Jay Garner will have 450 American administrators in the country. Do you know who they will sit down to work with?
They don't know themselves, I don't think. Many lines have yet to be drawn between who was too close to the previous regime, who wasn't. We've begun to see over the last week a lot more police and other of those types of officials emerge out of the woodwork. And people now, for the first time ever, saying, well, you know, they weren't so tainted by the regime. They were just professionals. Of course, we never heard that during the former regime. So those divisions are beginning to be made now. But some of these divisions also leave a bad taste in the mouths of many Iraqis. I mean, I've been surprised how many Iraqis have come up to me and say, you know, I just saw so-and-so wandering around, or I've just seen so-and-so kind of in negotiations with the Americans there. And they're just surprised that some of these people who they considered to be ranking people in the former regime are the people who Americans are talking to today.
Scott Peterson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me earlier today from Baghdad.
Tonight at 8:45 p.m. local time, the division began crossing into Iraq behind the 3rd Infantry Division, which by now is about 100 miles deep into Iraq.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and Washington Post correspondent Rick Atkinson in an interview with this program on March 21st, or A-Day, when the Pentagon launched its shock and awe campaign in Baghdad and U.S. troops moved into Iraq. A veteran war correspondent of the Persian Gulf War, Rick Atkinson was embedded with the Army's 101st Airborne Division and spoke to us that night from Camp New Jersey, Kuwait, as the division's troops began the long push north to Baghdad. Now, back in Washington, Rick Atkinson is talking with us tonight about his experience as an embed with the 101st, about the intimate, mile-by-mile, day-by-day, fight-by-fight of the invasion, about early lessons of the Iraq War, and the role of embedded journalists themselves. What did you make of the gusher of embedded reporting? How did you understand and absorb it? What's your question for a battlefront reporter in the Iraq War? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is 3-time Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post correspondent and historian Rick Atkinson. While embedded with the 101st Airborne Division in Iraq, Rick won this year's Pulitzer Prize for History for his most recent book, An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942-1943. It's the first in a liberation trilogy on World War II Europe. Good evening, and welcome back to On Point, Rick Atkinson.
Good evening, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Rick, set us up if you would. There's a lot we want to hear from you tonight, but just remind us exactly where you were situated in this war and the overall thrust of where the war took you and the 101st.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was embedded with the 101st Airborne Division, as you noted, and I was specifically in the headquarters of the 101st, at the elbow, basically, for the whole war of Major General David Petraeus, who's the commanding general of the 101st. We started actually in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, the home of the 101st, flew to Kuwait City at the end of February. We were in Kuwait City for several days waiting for the 3rd Infantry Division to clear out of Camp New Jersey and some of the other camps that were out in the Kuwaiti desert. We then moved to Camp New Jersey, about the 10th or so of March, and subsequently crossed into Iraq, I believe, on the 23rd of March. I flew with General Petraeus to a forward operating base Shell, which was 150 miles or so into Iraq, west of the Euphrates Valley. And we subsequently worked our way from Shell to a couple of other intermediate bases where the command post was set up. And we ended up in Baghdad. The 101st had the southwest quadrant of Baghdad, basically, as its responsibility. I was there until a week ago. Last Monday I left when the war had ended and things had settled into something that was closer to peacekeeping.
So, Rick, give us some context here for what your direct view of the war was compared to that of many other embed reporters we heard. You were with a very high-ranking officer through much of this. Did this mean that you were not at the elbow of the guys doing the shooting, or was it both? What was your day-to-day experience?
Well, it was really both, Tom, mainly because General Petraeus liked to be up front with his soldiers. He's an infantryman and wanted to be out there with his infantrymen. So we saw 3 pretty good firefights up close and personal in the towns of Najaf, in Karbala, and in Hilla. So I think I was actually positioned pretty well. I was able to see the war through a division commander's eyes, which allowed me to see up to core operations. I saw General William S. Wallace frequently. He was the 5th Corps commander, Petraeus' superior. And then certainly to see it down, I spent a lot of time with the brigade commanders, particularly the 3 infantry brigade commanders of the 101st, the 2 aviation brigade commanders, and then even down certainly in the battalion and company level. It was a very good perch, as it turned out.
Rick Atkinson, you wrote out of the Persian Gulf War, one of the definitive books on that war, Crusade, the Untold Story of the Persian Gulf War. Describe for us, if you would, compare your experience in reporting this war and that, and at the very top level, the 2 wars themselves.
Well, the wars are obviously quite different in several ways, even though the adversary was the same. For one thing, in 1990 and 91, there was a very long run-up to the war. There was about a 5-month build-up that allowed American forces and our allies to be positioned for a long time, mostly out of Saudi Arabia and to some extent out of Turkey. In this case, we had very few allies. First of all, instead of the coalition of 37, there was really a coalition of 2 this time, although there were a number of others that were nominally involved. It was the United States and the British. And everybody was crammed into Kuwait, which is a country the size of Rhode Island. And there was no haven in Turkey from which to launch air attacks. There was no long shared border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq with which to launch the famous left hook of 1991. And I think the political temper was different, too. I think the world had pretty well come to the conclusion collectively by mid-January 1991 that war was the proper course, that it was the only course that Saddam Hussein had left. And, of course, there was no such unanimity even in the United States, much less globally this time.
Did that affect the prosecution of the war itself?
I'm not sure that it really did. I think that the war plan, which had been drafted and redrafted for many months back into 2002, was altered somewhat by the fact that the Secretary of Defense decided, apparently in the middle of January, that rather than send the larger force that had been planned as part of the iterations of Operations Plan 1002V, as it was called, that he wanted to do it quicker, and he wanted to do it with a smaller force. And so you ended up having really just three divisions, the equivalent of three divisions, the 3rd Infantry Division, the 101st from the Army.
And of course, that developed ultimately into the great controversy of the war's low point, which you reported directly. We're going to come back and hear about that. We're talking tonight with 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson on his weeks embedded with 101st Airborne in Iraq. Please stand by, Rick. We've got to take a short break. Listeners, you can join us. What's your question for one of the most eminent embedded reporters of this war? Were you informed or frustrated by the up-close, narrow view each embedded reporter had of the war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're talking with 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson. He's just returned last week from being embedded with the 101st Airborne in Iraq for the Washington Post. You can join the conversation. What's your question for one of the most eminent embedded reporters of this war? Did the embed system work for you? Did it work for the country? Before the invasion of Iraq began, Rick spoke with us from Camp Doha, the main military base in Kuwait, about an army in anticipation of war.
People look around for things that might be useful in the field craft of a rustic environment like these camps, a piece of string lying on the street. You know, can I use that? Will it fit into my pack? There's a run on the PX supplies here. Baby wipes are a huge commodity. I'm holding one in my hand right now because the dust is so thick. It just coats everything almost instantly. So there is a transition period, I think, both collectively for the military and individually for these soldiers as they move from the habits of peace, the mentality of peace, into something that's much closer to war.
That was Rick Atkinson reporting from Camp Doha, Kuwait, on March 12th. He proceeded with the 101st Airborne Division to Iraq. Rick Atkinson, you reported one of the most... what you describe as a low point of the war in a Washington Post wrap-up piece with Peter Baker and Tom Ricks on March 27th outside the city of Najaf, where Lieutenant General William S. Wallace, you describe, was head of all Army ground forces in Iraq, I guess, and Major General David Petraeus, who you were with so much of the war, sitting on folding chairs in a desert wasteland. The war seemed to be in dismal shape. There had been the death or capture, they weren't sure which, of that maintenance group that had strayed from the path. The famous Apache helicopters had come in and been just shot to hell by small arms fire from the ground. There were sandstorms and uncertainty back in Washington and uncertainty about whether or not we had enough troops on the ground. You came out of that period with, along perhaps with others, of one of the most famous quotes of the war, where William Wallace said, the enemy we're fighting is different from the one we'd war gamed against. How low was that low point?
Well, I think that they were feeling alarmed, and they were feeling alarmed because of the reasons that you mentioned, and a couple of other things, too. The Army had moved a very long distance in a very short period of time. They'd really outrun their supply line. And even though they had anticipated a pause outside of Baghdad, this was a pause that was being enforced perhaps earlier than they had anticipated, and it was complicated by the fact that the supply lines were now vulnerable. It was clear that there were guerrilla raids that jeopardized the very long 200 miles or more supply line stretching back to Kuwait. The weather had turned very, very bad. There was basically a 3-day sandstorm that prohibited flying. It prohibited even things like looking for battle damage assessment to see how badly the Iraqis had been hit. So I think that they were a bit down in the mouth, and it's not uncommon for those in the field to believe that those in the rear, including the rear in Washington, not to fully understand what it is that they're facing. You find that in every war.
What was that like for senior officers like that? You described before the invasion began, David Petraeus all full of spitfire down in Kuwait, dropping and having push-up competitions with his men as they unloaded equipment from the big freighters there, pumping up the troops. What's it like in the field when the generals are sitting there thinking, what in the heck have we gotten into here?
Well, the burden of responsibility is obviously immense. If you're Dave Petraeus, you've got responsibility for 17,000 soldiers. He had never commanded in combat before. He's 50 years old. He's had an extraordinary career, really, beginning with his entry at West Point and his subsequent graduation near the top of his class. He married the superintendent's daughter and so on. So I think that there is a there's a level of anxiety that is only natural, and part of the art of command is not conveying that anxiety to your subordinates. And I believe that it would be almost inhuman to expect someone who's got that kind of responsibility and who at that point in the war sees things are not going quite as expected to. Mm-hmm. To be completely composed and indifferent to the circumstances.
And what about the officers under David Petraeus and the infantry men and perhaps women there? Did they know of the controversy that just roared up, as you know, in just a handful of days in the United States, a huge debate over whether or not this thing was completely misdesigned? Were troops aware of that? Were they asking each other, what have we been led into here? Or was that just a distant rumble?
It was really a distant rumble, and I must say that even at the division headquarters level, it was a very distant rumble. I was only dimly aware of it myself. We were extraordinarily busy. The task of just surviving day to day in remote portions of Iraq is hard enough as it is, and there's an 8-hour time difference. Communications are not great. And things that seemed immensely important here in Washington didn't seem so important out there, to be honest. Mm. And so I think that on the troop level, down with Sergeant Smith or Corporal Jones, they were completely unaware of it.
Rick Atkinson, as an embedded reporter, what were you not permitted to report?
Well, there was a long list of things that were not reportable and that every embedded reporter had to agree to. There was a formal signed document that laid out the rules of engagement basically between the military and the media. And most of them were obvious. You weren't going to report troop movements. You weren't going to report impending military operations. There were certain types of intelligence activities that you couldn't report.
But I guess at this point, looking back, were there incidents that you witnessed, that you have still not reported out of discretion, out of loyalty to the people you were traveling with, or out of compliance with those rules? Have you told the full story that's in your notebooks, Rick?
Well, obviously you can't tell the full story that's in your notebooks because there's not enough newsprint to do that. It's a very rich and layered experience going to war and being inside the division headquarters. So, no, there were a lot of things that I have not reported, but that's not because there are necessarily restrictions on it. The reality is that war is among the most complex of human endeavors, and just one day in active combat is an incredibly complex, convoluted, a murky thing, and trying to convey all of that in a piece for the Washington Post that at best might be 2,000 words is difficult.
But do you think that American readers, going through your reports and the reports of other embedded reporters in Iraq, at this point have an accurate depiction of what went on in this first round?
Well, I think that any war, and we certainly saw it in the Gulf War, and you know it's been true in World War II, and every war I think that's ever been fought in which there were reporters trying to do the first rough draft of history, there will be more things that come out. There will be things that reporters didn't really understand or didn't see. There will be reports of civilians killed that no one quite understood at the time. There will be reports of mishaps, maybe even misdeeds. But I think that the truth of the matter is the position that reporters were in this particular war, and I can really only speak for myself directly here, but I saw about as closely as possible this division, in particular this division headquarters, fight its war. I was given astonishing access. There was a great deal of trust. I was given access to secret and even top secret information, all with the proviso that I wasn't going to burn them and that I wasn't going to burn the soldiers. And I think that there were probably reporters among the 600 or so who were over there who had similar levels of access. And as a consequence, compared to the Gulf War in 1991, for example, it was much more clearly understood what had happened, and the inside, the mechanism of war was much more thoroughly reported, I believe.
Understood by you and reported by many, but you're saying that at this point you also think the American public has not just a spun version of the war, but a generally accurate version of the war.
I think it's generally accurate. I mean, I have to say that I can only, again, speak for myself. I didn't see the reports of the 600 other reporters over there. I saw really what was in the Washington Post in a cursory fashion. Occasionally saw pieces of the New York Times. But it's not like I could sit down and read the copy of everybody who was filing.
Sure.
Or all of the broadcasters. But I would be surprised, I guess, if, in fact, 10 years from now, we were to look back and say, gee, the first report is always wrong, which is a truism of the military, and the 600 reporters who were there really didn't get it right. It was much different than the picture they had drawn. I think that the differences, the modifications over time, the difference between journalism and history will be more on the margins than that.
Rick, I want to invite our callers in. Andy's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Evening.
I'm just calling. I watched a lot of the coverage on television, and it seemed to me that the American coverage and the British coverage differed somewhat from a television picture standpoint. Oftentimes, the American coverage would be from a video phone, and a lot of times it would be show firefights that were taking place a great distance away, where mm-hmm. I remember one British firefight, it seemed the reporter must have been only about 20 feet away, and horrible things were taking place, and it was quite clear and not so grainy. I was wondering if they American reporters were limited as to what they showed, or decided to edit what they showed. And
are you suggesting, Andy, a more kind of cleaned up, antiseptic version in the American media?
I'm not the only one that talked about it. Other people kind of noticed it too. It did seem that way.
Of course, we're looking at TV, but let's put it to Rick, who's a print guy. Rick Atkinson, how about it?
I just can't address what TV was doing. I did see a few TV reporters out there when I was with the 101st. I don't think that they were censoring what they were showing. I know I certainly wasn't censoring the brutality of it. I described these fights that I mentioned earlier at Najaf and Karbala and Hillah in considerable difference, in considerable detail. And that included the glitches, the screw-ups, the things that didn't go quite right for the military, and it included people getting killed. So I don't know what television was doing. I don't know why there was a difference between the American and British television presentation of the war, if indeed that was true.
But Rick, what about this general issue that's been raised of the concern, and I wonder what you think about it, that embedding reporters gave in this case 600 and some keyhole views of what was going on. It also brought those reporters into very intimate conditions with the military. There's been some concern that what it added up to was somehow a rah-rah version of the war. Do you see that dynamic slipping through somehow? Again, I know you were only where you were seeing what you saw, but is that risk there? Are we better off having reporters at a remove or right there with and dependent on U.S. troops?
Oh, I don't think that we're better having them at a remove. I think that, yeah, there's always the danger of the journalistic equivalent of Stockholm syndrome, I guess, where you become a devotee of your captors. I think that anybody covering any beat, whether it's the city sewer district or United States Army in action, has to maintain some distance and some perspective, and that's in part what editors are for, to remind you and to sift through what's coming in from the field and to put it together in a coherent fashion. I know that the Washington Post did that quite well. I'm very proud of the Post's product. The folks here in Washington, the foreign staff in particular, did quite brilliantly, I think, at making a coherent whole out of the pieces of patchwork that we who were working on the quilting bee were tossing to them. So, yeah, I think it's something that you have to be wary of. Whether or not there was a sugar-coated version of the war, I'll leave that for others to decide. I'm quite confident that I didn't sugarcoat.
Rick, you were the son of a U.S. Army officer. You grew up on military posts in the 50s and 60s. You've researched deeply the U.S. military in World War II. What's your sense of the fighting force that was in the field in Iraq? How is it related? How is it unlike the forces deployed in World War II and the way that these men and women went into combat in their attitudes toward their job and their attitudes toward what happened in this war?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Tom. I have spent a lot of time looking at the World War II Army, and as you mentioned, I have a book, An Army at Dawn, that came out in October, which is about the American Army in the North African campaign in 42 and 43. There are a number of singular differences between that army, of particularly the early World War II experience, and the current army. It's the army of World War II was an order of magnitude bigger. It was 8 million, which is more than tenfold the size of the current army. It was a drafty army in large measure. It was an army that wasn't nearly as well educated as the current army is. You can go down the list. It's an army that wasn't nearly as physically fit. It's an army that wasn't nearly as professional as the current
army. That is, in World War II, you're saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The World War II Army was not nearly as physically fit as the current Army is. Having said all that, and I could elaborate on that, on those differences, they're certainly of a piece, the current Army and the World War II Army, in a couple of fundamental ways. One is, I think, the sense that Army is representative of the nation. I think that's something that soldiers today feel very strongly. It's something that soldiers in World War II certainly felt. The sense that essentially when you come down to it, what they're fighting for is each other. They're not fighting for an abstraction. Certainly the Army that was out there in Iraq and is still out there to this day was not fighting for Iraqi liberation or the discovery of weapons of mass discovery, of mass destruction. Ultimately, when push comes to shove and they're shooting it out, they're fighting for one another. It's a kind of deep comradeship and even love that you find in combat. And that's something that a World War II soldier in 1943 would have recognized instantly.
You write about how at a certain point, when they finally got a kind of jubilation in response to their arrival in Najaf, they hadn't had much of that, that you saw soldiers begin to turn and for the first time, I don't remember the exact words, but began to think of this as something they were really doing for Iraq and feeling invested in what they were doing for Iraq, not for each other.
Yeah, that was an interesting phenomenon. I think that very few of the soldiers, certainly with 101st, felt that they had a stake in the war in a political sense. And when, in fact, in Najaf, and it first happened in Najaf, which is one of the holy cities of the Shiite Muslim world, after a fairly intense pounding that had gone on for a day, and the soldiers first began to push into the town and then got more than a toehold and got the town, and hundreds and then thousands of people came out to greet them, and there was cheering and there was waving and there were lots of smiles and so on. I think what you saw was a sense of possession about the war itself, about the cause, that was felt by many soldiers, a belief that that they really were liberators in a fundamental sense. And we saw it again in Karbala, and then we saw it again in Hilal, and we saw it to some extent in Baghdad, too.
Rick, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. Sure. We're talking with three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson on his weeks embedded with the 101st Airborne Division in Iraq. What did you want to ask a frontline reporter in the Iraq War? Ask it now, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson on his weeks embedded with the 101st Airborne Division in Iraq. You can join the conversation. What did you want to ask a frontline reporter in the Iraq War? And did the embed system work for you? Did it work for the country? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill's calling from Tomahawk, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Rick. First of all, I want to say that I got a lot of my information on the war from the radio, but I thought the embed system, you know, worked pretty well. I heard lots of reports, and they turned out to be, you know, on the whole, accurate, such as they were. And I, you know, I never really expected them to be all revealing or anything like that.
And given that no individual reporter could see the whole situation, but they were pouring out what they had.
Yeah. I had a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. The thrust of my question is an effort to understand the Arab military mind. And I didn't get the impression from the reporters in the field that they thought that the Iraqi army was cowardly. But rather, you know, the sense that I got of it was that when they could, they fought back. Some surrendered, but not all, and that they were willing to fight. I'm trying to understand why a man like Saddam Hussein and his commanders got into a fight that was obvious from the beginning that they were going to lose, that was going to really cost them. They never had weapons that could deal with Abrams tanks or with Apache helicopters.
Bill, they're great questions at the immediate military level and the larger level. Let me put them to Rick Atkinson, and thanks for your call. Rick, what about this issue of the Iraqis and their fight? They seemed to fight with much more vigor in the midsection of the country than the U.S. military expected, and it really seemed to set the U.S. troops' forces back on their heels. Then those forces approached Baghdad, and everything seemed to melt away. How would you refine that view?
Well, I think that the big surprise for the U.S. military was the fact that the fiercest fighting, the fiercest resistance, came not from the fielded Iraqi army or from the Republican Guard or from the Special Republican Guard, which was Saddam's personal Praetorian Guard, but really rather from the irregulars known as the Fedayeen, mm-hmm. and the equivalent of the National Guard. The notion that the Iraqi army was going to put up a spirited defense was believed by very few intelligence analysts who thought that the Republican Guard divisions, there were six of them, probably would fight, but it wasn't clear how fiercely they would fight. The regular army probably would not fight. They had not fought very well at all in 1991.
So how did commanders interpret the resistance they got from the Fedayeen as they moved up through the middle of Iraq?
Well, there was concern that this reflected kind of a groundswell of antipathy toward the American presence, and that, in fact, in every town you were going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of irregulars waging guerrilla war, attacking the flanks and rear of this very long American supply line. So while it had been initially planned to bypass the cities that were on the way from Kuwait to Baghdad, Najaf, Karbala, and Hilal in particular, it was decided that they couldn't do that they had to take down the cities and to suppress these attacks. And so the strategy evolved considerably. And then it turned out that the resistance was pretty brittle. It was a thin crust, and there were not thousands who were willing to immolate themselves on behalf of Saddam Hussein's regime. In each of these cities, there were probably a few hundred, and they were certainly no match for American military firepower.
What was the experience of the soldiers you were with in facing that resistance? We heard and saw reports of Iraqis sort of running toward tanks just with an AK-47 or just with a pickup truck, being really mowed down in large numbers with very few casualties on the U.S. side. How did U.S. soldiers, how did they deal with that? What did they think of what they were doing there? Did this feel like the right task for military people? Did it feel like a slaughter?
Well, this did happen on a couple of occasions. It happened primarily with the 3rd Infantry Division, which was the mechanized spearhead that went into Baghdad first after crossing near these other cities that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. I think that the anxiety that commanders felt was spurred in part by this notion that there were effectively suicidal waves coming at American soldiers. They were concerned about the impact that it might have on the soldiers to be mowing down these waves of fanatics, or so it seemed. I think that the reality was that this was a short-lived phenomenon, and those who wanted to impale themselves on an armored spearhead impaled themselves early, and the others either decided that that was not a good tactic, or they lost heart, melted back into the cities, melted into the countryside. I don't think that there was any real reluctance by the soldiers of the 3rd Division, from what I understand, to fight on as a consequence. I think that that division, by the time they got to Baghdad, was pretty hardened. They'd had four soldiers killed in a car bomb, a suicide car bomb. And I think that there was not a reluctance to do what had to be done to put down what resistance there was in Baghdad.
And what about Bill's larger question? You must have thought about it and talked about it at some point with commanders and soldiers there about the position Iraq had taken, the position that put them in the position of facing this huge, or powerful, I should say, American force. How were people interpreting it?
Well, it does seem irrational, doesn't it? There was no way that they were going to stand up to the power that the American Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines could bring to bear.
Did it look on the ground as though they just didn't think Americans would ever push that power right into the country?
I think there was a suspicion that the Iraqis thought they could bluff their way through. They had tried that in 91, and they had succeeded to some extent because we did not drive beyond the Euphrates. I think that also there was probably a bit of blindness, myopia by the senior commanders in Iraq, starting with Saddam Hussein himself. I think he'd only been out of the country twice in his life. I don't think he really had an understanding of what he was facing. Even though he'd been whipped in 1991, he'd rescued a partial political victory from it, and I'm sure that he thought that he could do the same. Supposedly he's a great student of the Vietnam War and thought if he could just bleed the Americans enough that he would ultimately win politically, even if he could not win militarily.
Tom's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. I knew David Bloom. I worked with him about 15 years ago, and he was the who died of a pulmonary embolism about a week or two ago working for NBC.
Right.
When you hear something like that, does that concern you? Does that make your heart drop? Does it make you be a little more careful in what you're doing? You are right out there in the line of fire, so to speak.
Rick Atkinson, I read in your reporting at one point a mortar shell dropping, I don't know, 40 yards or so from headquarters tent, as I read it. You, of course, knew about David Bloom and Michael Kelly's deaths for yourself, for other embedded reporters. How great a concern was injury and or death?
Well, you can't sneer at it. And obviously, those were great tragedies. Michael Kelly, one of the great talents of my generation in the print business, and David Bloom, who had actually called me from Kuwait City before I left for the Middle East, was a very talented guy and a real sweetheart. You know, it's a dangerous profession, and if you go into a war zone as a soldier or as a reporter, you're obviously putting yourself at risk. You try to minimize the risk as best you can. I thought I was in a pretty good position being at the elbow of a division commander, and turned out this division commander had a taste for the front lines, and we did get shot at on several occasions. But you pays your money, you takes your chances. I think there were 12 reporters who killed or died otherwise in the war. The percentage of reporters who die in conflicts tends to be, believe it or not, higher than the percentage of soldiers. So
was in this conflict, if you look at those ratios.
I think that's right, yeah.
Mike is calling from Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the show. I got a question about the aftermath of the war. I'm sure your guest deserves a good break away from the desert. But what about the follow-up? What sort of responsibilities does the media now have to ensure that people can easily forget? I noticed that the network news, for example, now on TV is more or less devoid of substantial news. That's my opinion. But, could you talk to that issue, please?
Are you afraid, Mike, that Iraq will go the way of Afghanistan and kind of slide off the...
I've commented to a few people recently. What have we heard about Afghanistan recently? Really not very much, unless you're the kind of person who seeks out the news. You know, that there are some details, but it scares me that there's been so much focus on our on the military occupation or the military involvement for three or 4 weeks or so of it. There's an obvious diminishment that would probably take place, but how can what sort of responsibilities does the media have now to maintain what is perhaps an even more important involvement between Britain and America in Iraq right now?
Mike, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Rick?
Well, that's a good question, and there is a responsibility. The Washington Post had 20 people in the region at the height of the war. I think there's still 14 or so there, including a fresh wave that has come in while those of us who've been there for a long time have come out. But there is a sense that the nation's gaze is kind of wandering elsewhere, and I believe that particularly when we've got tens and tens of thousands of soldiers still over there, many of whom are going to be there for a long time, it's incumbent on the media generally to remind people that we've got that kind of investment in our most treasured asset, our young men and women who are there, who are still in harm's way, or still in a nasty place. It's very hard living over there. And so I think that you'll see a good faith effort by most media outlets, certainly the Washington Post I can speak to keep covering the story. It's not a military story as much anymore, but it's an important and complex story, and it will go on and on.
A follow-up on that, I guess Donald Rumsfeld said today, refuting a New York Times story, Rumsfeld denied that the U.S. plans to have long-term military bases in Iraq. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know. I did hear his denial. It was pretty vehement. It's hard for me to imagine that the United States isn't going to keep some sort of military toehold there for a while. I take him at his word that there are no imperialistic ambitions there. But I think that's something that the media also needs to keep an eye on. Obviously, there is a great commercial boon awaiting in Iraq. They currently export 2 million barrels of oil a day. They've got the second largest reserves, I believe, in the world after Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of money to be made there, and there are a lot of companies obviously waiting to make it.
But you've paid a lot of attention to the U.S. military. You know the pressure for them to get out of Saudi Arabia. Can you imagine that they'll walk away from Iraq and not leave a U.S. base behind, or as the Times had it, four bases, kind of at four corners of the country practically?
Well, it's hard to imagine them doing that in the short term. I think if the United States military were to leave now, you would have chaos and civil war and anarchy. And if you're going to leave American soldiers there, you've got to have some way of basing them and fortifying them. Whether there's a long-term plan to that effect, I don't know. I would guess I would be surprised if there wasn't some kind of plan. They plan for everything, and why not plan for a long occupation of Iraq?
Rick Atkinson, we've just got a minute left. Was this a new kind of war? Was this something between the old and new? How do you describe it?
I don't know if it was new. I think that the expeditionary warfare has become the rule rather than the exception in America of the present day. I think that the way the war was covered was somewhat new. I think integrating reporters into the force, while not a totally new thing, I've been embedded twice before in Bosnia and in Somalia. But the scope of it was different this time, and the intimacy of it, I think, was somewhat different. But I think Iraq is just the latest way station in a sequence of what are likely to be expeditionary skirmishes or all-out wars of one sort or another.
Are we going to find you in the middle of another one? Some people were surprised after you'd sort of turned to the history line to find you back in the middle of this one.
Yeah.
Maybe you were surprised.
I was a little surprised myself. I'm not as young as I once was, but it's a great way to stay in touch with the Army, and it's a great way of keeping faith with the institution. I won't rule anything out. I'm glad to be home.
Rick Atkinson, we're glad you're home, and thanks for your reporting from Iraq. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Rick Atkinson, 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner. He won the 2003 Pulitzer for history for his book An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942 to 1943. He was embedded with the headquarters of the 101st Airborne in Iraq. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.